Cleveland, late fall 1946. The war is over and an uneasy peace hovers over the country, clouded by the return of U.S. hostilities against the Soviet Union. American working people had fought first the Great Depression and then the World War, and felt entitled to a share in the war-inflated prosperity that had set record-breaking profits for businesses. Joe Chaudet of the International Typographical Union, an editor of the East Bay Labor Journal in that period, gives his sense of the mood of the country.
Well, I think the general labor situation at that time, it was kind of in a state of flux, because we had all of the young fellows coming back from the war that had fought for their country. Peace had been declared. They came on back and they were looking for jobs. The economy started to move up, but there was a great deal of unrest because of the fact that after all, these people had come out of a lot of turmoil. The veterans had come out of a lot of turmoil, shooting. They saw their friends get killed and everything else. They came back with the idea, well, I want to remake the world. You know, I mean, this is just my feeling about it, you ask, and that's just about it. But there was a great deal of unrest. We're not going to take it anymore in a lot of respect. You know, we're going to try and build a better America, but by God, we're not going to take any more guff in trying to build this. And I think that this was one of the things that happened in 46 and also in later years. We saw that after the Vietnam War, during the Vietnam War, with these people saying, look, I've done my part. I think I paid my dues as an American citizen. I want my fair share.
There had been a business labor truce during most of the war, and the militant labor movement of the 30s was in mothballs. For business, 1946 seemed the ideal time to roll back the gains made by labor in the New Deal period. The drive for the open shop was started again, and workers sensed a continued determination of business to keep a lid on salaries while raising prices instantly once wartime profit controls were lifted. Organizing drives were treated with layoffs and lockouts. Joe Chaudet.
Look, they were all billionaires or millionaires. Look at Kaiser. Look at Henry J. Kaiser, a multi-billionaire. Look at all of the shipbuilding. Look at the airplane factories. Look at all of that. They made it all. Then when these people came on back, and I mean, you know, my brother Americans and also the gals that came back from the war, and when they held out their hand for just a little piece of pie, the answer was no. The answer was no completely. We're not going to have unionization. It was all right during the war, but no more. No more. We had to do it. We had to sign a contract with the government for fair employment. We had to sign a contract because of the fact that they were in the driver's seat. Now we're in the driver's seat. And they had no more sympathy for those people coming back than the man in the moon. Look, the only thing that they're were interested and still are is the almighty buck.
This offensive by business was met by a record-breaking strike wave in 1946. 5,000 strikes involving over 4.5 million workers marched out in coal, auto, railroads, utilities, communications, and municipal government. Food prices rose by 28% in the last 6 months of 1946, and corporate profits were higher than in the peak years during the war. Wages, on the other hand, were lower than in 1940, and in addition, women had a special reason to be concerned with the labor situation, as Joe Chaudet explains.
I think the war gave an impetus to women for their individual freedom and individual right to be a wage earner. And, what was the song, Rosie the Riveter? You know, what they did. And if it hadn't been for the women, I don't think we'd have ever won a war. And I think that after the war, it was just a question of this same, I want mine. You know, I want to live like a free human being. I want some dignity. And I think that that's one of the reasons that they turned to the labor movement and to get organized. These women were used to paychecks, you know, and they were out, and they were free, and they were working, and they realized what money meant, because before the old man took care of that, you know, in a lot of respects. He was the wage earner. But these women got out, they got a sense of freedom, they belonged to unions, whether they liked them or not, you know. But nevertheless, the wages were good, the overtime was good, they made good money. So then, after the war was over, the balloon kind of burst, the shipyards closed. Where else to go? Department stores, being waitresses, working in department stores, doing these various things. And so I think this is one of the reasons that they tended to not flock toward it, but they tended to look upon the department stores and this more or less genteel labor as an open field.
Al Kidder was an employee of Conn's, one such department store in downtown Oakland.
1946 is when that was, the organizing campaign was put forth, and it was during the period of July and August. At that time, they were trying to organize in the department store field in Oakland. Conn's and Hastings were picked because at that time it was felt that the people wanted to join the union, wanted to have a union in there to represent them. Well, when the company found out about the organizing within the store, what precipitated the strike was the firing of one of the people who had joined the union. One of the ladies who had joined and signed up with the union was fired. And the strike took place in, I believe it was October the 8th, or October anyway, right in that time, because my son was born the 8th of October, and I know we'd just gone on a strike. So that's one of the things that keeps that memory open. That was on Conn's, right.
And then what happened with Hastings?
Hastings followed suit right after that.
What were the conditions at these two stores that made people want to join the union?
Well, we were fighting the old conditions. I can remember when my mother worked in downtown Oakland, the apartment stores, and they had what they called the ready room, that a woman would go down at 8 o'clock in the morning and sit there with the hope all day long of being called to a department and getting 2 or 3 hours work in. And this is the type of things you were fighting in a department store in those days, before the war, during the Depression, right after the Depression, you just go down and just hope that maybe some department wouldn't have enough people there, or they had a busy day so they'd need somebody for a couple of hours, you'd get a couple of hours work in. And this is why, basically, a union was needed. I was working in the shoe department, and I was making, $28 a week at that time. And, just getting out of the service and not having really something you could call a background of where to go to work. We had union shoe stores right around Conn's. Working in the area, you've invariably talked to people in the other stores, and I found out the union stores were making in the area of around $42 a week. And all I could think of was the fact that if we got the union there, I'd make 42 instead of 28. And I think this was basically the reason for all the people.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, don't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter'll be the straw boss then.
In their attempts to organize, Conn's and Hastings employees were up against more than just their own management. The business community of Oakland was strongly united in its efforts to prevent unionization. This business establishment was led by the Oakland Tribune and its publishers, Joseph Noland and his son, William Noland. The Tribune had long been known for its virulent stance against labor, minorities, communists, real or imagined, and progressive thought in general. These same forces headed up a coalition of the Chamber of Commerce, Kaiser Industries, and the Retail Merchants Association, or RMA, the representative of the department stores, as well as the local government. The RMA played a key role in the events that led up to the strike.
What was the Retail Merchants Association and Conn's and Hastings' response to the organizing drive after the war?
Well, their response to any organizing drive by any organized labor movement was do everything in their power to keep it from happening.
Al Kidder.
The Retail Merchants Association, RMA, has changed over the years, but this was their policy back in those days, that you couldn't have a union contract and be a voting member. And that was prior to the Taft-Hartley.
Although the clerks' union had enrolled over half of the Conn's and Hastings workers, the employers represented by the Retail Merchants Association contended that all 28 stores in the association must be unionized in order for the union to be recognized as the proper bargaining agent for any of their stores. Joe Chaudet.
I mean the unit to be organized, was all of the stores in the Retail Merchants Association. So they went on out and they got these mom-and-papa stores. Well, a mom-and-papa store is not going to vote for union organization. What does it mean? There's no way, if they'd have thrown in every union organizer in the United States of America in Oakland, there's no way they're going in and organize every mom-and-papa store that have all the relatives working, you know?
What was the clerk's response?
The clerk's response was, it's impossible. And when this came down, and this is, I think, one of the things that led to the strike there.
Al Kidder.
The strike was called, and the picket lines were put out, and everything, more or less, we had the full cooperation of the entire labor movement. Yeah, there was all sorts of moves to get the pickets off, to limit the number of pickets, to keep you a certain distance from the doors, to 4 pickets to a door, 3 feet in the doorway, continuous moving, couldn't stop. You had to keep them moving, keep the pickets moving at all times. These were little harassing efforts by the company to make it more and more difficult to continue the picketing, to make it effective. Now, we had problems, but we never had anything that really got completely out of hand until the time that the general strike happened.
How effective was the picket line in preventing people from shopping at Conn's and Hastings?
It was very effective, really. Percentage-wise, I couldn't tell you that, but I do know that it was effective enough to make the company do everything in their power to get us off. Originally, we had somewhere in the area of between 70 and 80% of the workers came out. And I would say the same thing applied at Hastings. The company hired people to work behind the picket lines. There's no question about that. I mean, they got people to man the stores.
With Teamsters Local 70 refusing to cross clerk picket lines, Conn's and Hastings were running short on merchandise, badly needed for an expected profitable Christmas season.
Well, we'd had rumors going off and on for several weeks that they were going to bring in merchandise from Southern California through this trucking outfit. We had pickets on, or somebody watching the store 24 hours a day at that point to make sure nothing was going to happen. And then we had the Teamsters, along with ourselves, were watching all of the trucking outlets to see, and then they had people out on the highways watching for the trucks coming up. So actually, we had it pretty well covered as far as trying to see whether or not these trucks were coming in.
According to Ash, Police Chief Tracy informed the union that they could legally park their cars in the marked loading zones around Conn's and Hastings on the weekend. This action would effectively block deliveries to the two stores. Tracy also agreed to let Ash accompany him as he frisked professional scab truckers for weapons that they were expected to carry. Joe Chaudet.
No one can ever convince me that, you know, the program wasn't set. Now nobody can come in with the chief of police of Oakland riding an open car with Paul St. Cyr, head of the United Employers, with Joe Nolan sitting there, with Bob Tracy there, with the chief of police leading the way on a motorcycle, or Wyman Vernon, it seems to me, was his name, leading the way. Maybe he was driving, bowing to the populace, coming right down through all of the people that were out there, bowing. The streetcars at that time were stopped, bowing right and left. By God, they were going to put the labor movement in its place. No one can ever convince me that this thing didn't have to be so well planned, because we didn't find out until later on that all of the stuff that they moved in, all of the merchandise that moved in, was stored out in Hinks and Berkeley. You'd have thought it was conquering heroes coming home from the war. These fellas, the only thing that was missing, they didn't wear top hats. The police had done their job the night before when they beat us all out of the alleys. Pushed us with those damn billy clubs. I was black and blue here for months. And they all marched over, I don't want to use the expression, in Prussian goose steps. But it was damn near that, when they all marched over and walked right on down the alley, pushed all of the pickets out, because we had heard that this was going to happen. Pushed us down the alley, pushed us back, pushed us out to 17th Street, pushed us all the way down to Broadway Franklin, pushed us down to there, pushed down to 12th Street, set up machine guns right in the middle of the square, facing Conn's, right in the middle of the square, had all of the cops just taking their billy clubs, shoving you this way, bumping you, hitting you in the throat, doing any damn thing just to get you out. Pushed all of the labor people out of the alleys down the street, put out a cordon right around Cons, right around Cons and Hastings. Then all of a sudden the parade started. The only thing, as I say, they missed was top hats and a brass band. And there they rode, right straight down Telegraph Avenue, right on up. The trucks followed right behind them, went on in and unloaded. Then they went back to get more. By that time, the streetcars were stopped due to the Carmen's Union. They weren't going through the picket lines.
As picket captain, Al Kidder was present at the scene and witnessed one of labor's first reactions to the police activity.
The way it came about is that they cordoned off the 8 square blocks, and Al Brown, I think it was Al Brown was his name, was the head of the Carmen's local at that time. The streetcars were still running on Broadway. And he came down Broadway in a streetcar. And the police were out there, and they then had Broadway blocked off. And he came up to the blockade, and the cop said, "It's all right, you can take your streetcar through." And he said, "Well, what's the deal?" They told him what they were doing, and he said, "Well, no, I consider this a police picket line, and I've never crossed a picket line in my life, and I'm not about to now." So he climbed out, he took the controls out of the streetcar, climbed out of the streetcar, and that was it. That was the spark that started the whole thing at that particular time, because every streetcar backed up behind him. They couldn't move his streetcar. He told the buses to stop, and they had an emergency meeting, and for 3 days, just about, nothing turned in Alameda County.
Joe Chaudet.
It wasn't bringing in strike breakers necessarily that started the general strike. You know, I thought about that a lot since that. We'd seen strike breakers. But the thing was, using the police force that we were paying taxes for to beat us off our own streets. We couldn't even walk down the main street of Oakland. Now, this is the first step toward fascism.
Bob Ash, as part of the Central Labor Council, remembers the union leadership's reaction to the events of the day.
Then following that, we rounded up all of the Labor Council Executive Board members that were down there and had a meeting Sunday morning. And decided what to do. At that meeting, James Marshall, the president of Local 70, the Teamsters Union, said that Monday morning the Teamsters were not going to roll. They were going to stop all the trucks from going. And that if we didn't go along with him, why, we knew what we were. We were chicken. So we prevailed upon Marshall to hold it up until Tuesday till we could get all of the executive boards of the local unions would fill in for the council into a meeting. We had the meeting, sent wires to all of them. We had them in Monday morning. And at that meeting, the vote was taken that we hit the streets. Other than one, why, it was a loud, unanimous vote. We didn't call it general strike. We called it a work holiday. Hit the streets, so we let her go. We went out shut it down on Tuesday morning.
In 1946, the AFL and CIO were separate and sometimes antagonistic labor organizations, with the CIO representing the more radical and the AFL the more conservative wing of the labor movement. In Oakland, CIO unions represented workers at the docks, utilities, and some factories. On December 2nd, the day before the general strike, they publicly offered their support to the efforts of the clerks and the AFL.
At this initial planning of the general strike, what was the possibility of CIO participation raised?
None. None at all.
Joe Chaudet.
The thing was, we'll do this ourselves. At that time, they had two different camps, the left wing and the right wing in the CIO. Not the right wing. The left wing and the CIO regulars, you know, the steel workers and a few of that. But none at all. They tried to horn in the left wing, and they were told, get out. Get around, get away. We don't want any part of you. Don't even hang around the fringes. We want none of you.
What was the reason for that?
Because of the fact that right away you're licked. Because right away the Tribune comes out, you had a headline down there, general strike. Right away, if we'd have picked up a couple of those unions in the CIO, we'd have... The commies are running it. It's a commie general strike. It was never, at no time was there a tinge of it. At no time, Craig, was there even a breath of it. And we didn't want him around.
How did the word get out? How do you call a general strike?
We got on the radio and announced that as of whatever time it was, Tuesday morning, you know, we were on a general strike on a work holiday.
Bob Ash.
And all the unions got their business representatives to go out and start notifying the people. It was in the newspapers, of course, and everybody knew it was down. There wasn't much programming to it except to let's go, and we did it.
Joe Chaudet.
Complete, utter, planned chaos. What do you do in a general strike? There'd been, what, four? This was a fifth in the country, or there'd been seventh. Well, I don't know. What do you do? I'll never forget Harry Lundberg, who was head of the Seamen's Union, you know. He says, you guys run a general strike like a bunch of amateurs. Who knows how to run a general strike, you know? There's no planning, there's no nothing. What we did, we shut the town down, period. And some of the most ludicrous things that happened, some guy came down and made a plaintiff plea on knees before some committee that they appointed. Because he had a load of Christmas trees going and he couldn't get them shipped. In fact, there wasn't even elevators running in the Hotel Leamington. People had to walk all the way up the top of the Hotel Leamington. There was no elevators running, union elevators, you know, where they had the union operators under the Building Service Employees Union. Nothing was running. And grocery stores down, ground to a halt. You couldn't buy gas. The streetcars weren't running. The Tribune didn't publish. The Post and Enquirer didn't publish. I was president of the Typographical Union at that time, the Printers Union. They didn't publish a blooming thing for during the length of the strike. I mean, it was a complete shutdown of a city. Nothing was being delivered. Restaurants were closed. I think that's one of the reasons that it had to end, because everybody was getting hungry. And when the paper doesn't come, what happened? You know, what's happened? You know, and then the people of the city of Oakland realized that this was a serious thing. And I think that that swung as a public opinion to our side. I think they were on the side of the strikers. Because when they walk out, there's no paper there, and there's just a few radio stations, and all they're screaming all day long is a general strike, but that paper's not there to give their biased side of the story. You know, to get their pitch in, then the people, you know, have to think, well, look, there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. And I think that this is one of the things that made a success out of that general strike.
Dan Brough, a clerk and warehouse worker and photographer for the East Bay Labor Journal at the time of the strike, was on the streets and describes the atmosphere of the 6,000 to 10,000 people around the stores.
Well, the only word I can think of is militant. They were very, very militant in their desire to bring a thing to a conclusion as speedily as possible with the least amount of actual property damage or physical damage to anybody involved. The strikers and the leaders kept harping on peaceful picketing and a peaceful atmosphere, but you cannot maintain a peaceful atmosphere when you're attacked by the opposition physically. You're going to have to fight back, or you're going to get an awful lot of lumps. There was not only masses of union people, but there were a great many of the strike breakers, the hired strike breakers that were hired to mingle with and create dissension out on the streets. If they could destroy my camera, they would have done it. I don't recall any incident of actual rioting per se. Yes, there were multiple altercations and actual physical contact when there was a group from the employers who ran in a rat pack. Well, then, yes, the people on the street assembled in like numbers or possibly a little more to take care of the situation, but it was not promulgated by the man on the street. It was by the the hired strike breakers, the only thing I can call them, the Teamsters, after the incident of the trucks, they did have patrolling squads that would try to come in and break up these things before the police arrived, because in each case, when the police got there, they'd arrest the picket and let the person who actually started the whole thing and was the responsible party and would let them go off scot-free.
Joe Chaudet.
Everybody was marching around. They had a band on there or something. It just was chaos, that's all. Nobody knew, no direction, no nothing, you know. And nothing was moving. Where else are you going to go? Well, the theaters were down, the restaurants were down. What are you going to do? Everybody was having a good time, but the crowd was good. Nothing unruly. I didn't see any liquor, didn't see any. Well, where could you buy it? It was a holiday mood. It was a feeling of comradeship. And I think that this is one of the reasons that the veterans that had come back from the war, you know, it was kind of a throwback to their days, you know, when they were in the service, which hadn't been too long ago. And it was the feeling that, well, we're all together in this thing, you know. And it was a good, warm, healthy feeling. It was more like what this country should be. I mean, that is the feeling that I had. So it was an orderly, but I mean, the noise and everything else, you know, and cheering and running and everything, you know. This union's out, this union out, that's on, rah, 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 you know, that was it. And then all of the wild rumors, you know. Hear this, hear this, hear this, forget it. Don't pay any attention to rumors. They realized, you know, what they had done. You know, we did this, nobody else. And that's a good feeling. We did this, and we'll call the shots, you know. And it was real good. But during it, there were several meetings at the Athens Club with all of the big rigs in Oakland and the Downtown Merchants Association. My God, you thought, oh, the tears were so, you know, wrecking the city of Oakland and everything else. Nothing could wreck the city of Oakland, especially something like that. But it was humorous. It was humorous. But Oakland never suffered as much from the general strike as they have from the stupidity at City Hall. With it all, if we had a general strike every 3 or 4 years, they'd never do the damage that the backward thinking at City Hall by the city officials have done to this potentially the greatest city, one of the greatest cities in the United States.